Welcome to the business discussion. It's not unusual that debate topics in one way or another connect to economics and the business world. To argue those topics, you need a good idea of what business is all about in a theoretical sense. That's what this lecture is for. It should help you understand basic business and point to different ways you can approach resolutions that revolve around business issues. This is not an economics treatise. Economics is a very real academic discipline. This is just an introduction to ideas with some economic relevance. Okay, to begin with, we need to pin down what we're talking about when we say business. A business is the trading of a product or a service, the buying and selling of things, in other words. And the things that we are buying and selling can be pretty much anything that can be bought or sold. Or at least anything that someone is willing to sell that someone else is willing to buy. Now, this may all sound obvious, but if you don't have both buyers and sellers, you don't have a business. And anything, any physical object or any action, can be the content of that business. You can buy and sell something that is a resource, like coal or oil or arguably wheat. You can buy and sell manufactured goods, from hand-knitted socks to automobiles to computers. You can buy and sell services, as do, say, doctors or stockbrokers or theatrical agents. The thing we're calling business is the process of the buying and the selling. It's not an exaggeration to say that business is a primary cause of civilization, or maybe even the primary cause of civilization. Because business is that important a part of human existence. And maybe that's why it keeps popping up in debate topics. Business goes as far back as we as people go back. It goes back, as all good subjects do, to part one, the dawn of civilization. Imagine, if you will, human beings before civilization. Our proverbial cavemen and cavewomen, in other words. The belief is that humans originally lived as extended families or tribes that were self-sufficient. The tribe produced or found what it needed to survive. No doubt there was a little trading going on, if modern tribes are any indication, but in a society without a lot of objects, and in which the production or acquisition of most of those objects are within the grasp of the individual, the need for trade is minimal. Many Native American tribes, for instance, built a life around the buffalo. This one abundant animal provided food, clothing, housing, household objects made from the bones, and, of course, religious materials. Throw in a little corn and potatoes on the side, and you've got pretty much everything you want and everything you need. Technology was simple, too. Manufactured goods could be manufactured pretty much by anyone in the tribe. There might be some division of skill sets. I mean, there's only so much time in the day, and maybe someone is a little better at something than someone else. But in the main, anyone and everyone could be a jack of all trades, because the trades weren't hard to master. Anyone can sharpen a bone into a needle. All you need is the time to do it. So, everything you want and everything you need. When you got that covered, you're golden. But what if you find something you want that you didn't want before? Or something you need that you didn't need before? Then you've got to figure out some way to get it. Although at the moment we're playing fast and loose with the ideas of want and need, which are crucial to much of business, imagine what might have happened in the old tribes. Joe, other tribe guy, turns up one day, and old Joe has a bag of pepper with him. Now, pepper was totally new to our tribe. Makes all that buffalo and corn and taters taste way better all of a sudden. Now we want pepper. It could become so important to us that we start to need pepper. Now certainly if we replaced the idea of pepper with the idea of salt, which not only makes food taste good, but can help preserve it for long periods, we can easily find ourselves needing salt from the minute we discover it. We can create all sorts of wants and needs where there were none before. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Add to this the development of technology. It's one thing to make bone needles, but as technology develops, people really do specialize. One guy makes jewelry. Another guy makes wagons. One tribe has gold. Another tribe has diamonds. More needs and more wants develop. So originally, societies are small, self-contained, and self-reliant. Resourceful enough, if you will, to survive alone. But for one reason or another, they find themselves wanting or needing other things. A better axe, a prettier bead, tastier food, it doesn't matter. At that point, they seek out other tribes or societies that have what they want or need, and they begin trading. They do this where it makes sense to do it. That is, they can't go downtown to meet with Joe, other tribe guy, because downtown doesn't exist yet. They have to invent downtown. And so they do. And they invent it exactly where it makes sense to invent it. Think about it. If you were going to invent a town, where would you put it? That's the real question. What it is simple enough to understand, a place to do business. So it need be no more than a bunch of tents when you're starting out. But where do you put those tents? Well, if cities arise from trade, as we're postulating, then the best place to build a city is some place where it's easy for traders to get to. On roads, on rivers, at junctions of roads and rivers. You could, if you wanted to, build a city anywhere. But if you want it to be a good place for trade, you'll build it where people can get to it. Think of the cities that have survived for centuries or even millennia. Cairo, Rome, London, Paris, Venice, Beijing. All of these are easily accessible. Some of them easily accessible not only in their own limited geography, but to the entire world. What a great place to build a city. This fact of city placement remains a constant, although in some technological future, trade routes may no longer require roads as we know them, and we'll decide to maintain cities or not for other reasons. But most successful cities are on trade routes, usually at crossroads and occasionally at resource centers, that is, located near a natural resource. New York, Philadelphia, and Boston are our three biggest local cities, and I'm talking about the Northeast now. And they're big cities because they have great natural harbors, a place to put your boat. From the very beginning, boats could land there safely, and they could load and unload easily. Cities were built on the Hudson because of the river. You could build cities wherever you wanted to on the Hudson, especially when there was a nice little nook to park your boat. And people could get to these because they're right on the river. So these cities were built primarily where there were resource centers or connections by land to other cities. Around here, where I'm talking, Peekskill has stone, for instance. Stone is used, obviously, in building. It also has a good strategic military position on the Hudson because it's at a bend in the river where the banks are not too far apart. West Point is right up the road from us. Do note that military and protection and position is another key cause of city placement, but for our purposes, it's trade and trade routes that are primary. The point of all this ancient history is to show how markets came into existence. Markets, that's a new word here. As soon as there was a place to do business, business was done in that place. Did the place come first or the business? It doesn't matter. The end result was that a place to do business now existed, a real geographic place, and that place contained, or was, the market. Markets have, since the dawn of time, driven civilization. And civilization, since the dawn of time, has driven markets. Part 2, the components of business. The words market and business are not interchangeable. Words do not mean the same thing. Business, which in its simplest form is buying and selling, is what one does in a market. A market is a place for the transaction of business. The word marketing, by the way, has another meaning altogether, in essence, the art of selling. A company is an organization created for the purpose of doing business. We'll try to keep our language clear going forward. All the concepts we're going to discuss are fairly simple, but if we muddy them up with confused language, we'll lose the benefits of that simplicity, and that's the last thing we want to do. So here's how we'll describe business, the buying and selling of a product or a service. Buying and selling of a product or service. In other words, you need something to sell, you need someone to sell it, and you need someone to buy it. As straightforward as the day is long. And that leads directly into the three main components of business: the owners, the workers, and the customers. We'll take them one at a time. The owners. The owners are the ones who directly reap the profits from selling a product or service. The workers. The workers are the ones who create the product or service that is for sale. The customers. The customers are the people who purchase the product or service. It would be nice to be able to neatly divide and portray these three different groups, but they vary from business to business, and they vary from company to company. And we'll try to cover some major permutations as we progress. Okay, let's look at the owners. The owners are the ones who directly reap the profits from a business. Now, if you have a one-person company where the owner is the person who does all the work, there's no unique worker group in that business. It's just the one guy. If you have a small company, well, maybe there's an owner who reaps all the profits, but there's also a small group of workers who create the product or service. Now, in a really big company, there may be more than one owner. There can be multiple owners, each of which owns a certain share of the company, shareholders, in other words. In this really big company, there are probably dozens of workers, if not hundreds or thousands. They not only create the product or service, but sell it, promote it, advertise it, etc. But the story is the same no matter how large. The owners make the profits, the workers create the product, the customers buy it. The only thing that changes is the magnitude of the enterprise. And note also, as a company grows, the potential for multiple roles. Workers can own stock in their own company and be partial owners, and workers can purchase the products of their own company and also be consumers. There are not necessarily hard boundaries among the groups, although at any one time the needs and desires of a person in any one group may or may not coincide with the needs and desires of any other group. We'll see how that works shortly. It's important to keep in mind that the three different components of business have different, often conflicting, goals. As far as the owners are concerned, there is one simple goal: to make a profit. While owners may have additional goals, making a profit is primary. No other goal is achievable if, first, the company doesn't make more money than it spends. Other possible goals may be humanitarian or ecological, like Ben & Jerry's, for instance, before they were bought out by an international conglomerate, were very big on helping the environment. Granola eaters, that kind of thing. As far as the workers are concerned, there is one simple goal: to make a reasonable wage for work performed. While workers may have additional goals, making a reasonable wage is primary. No other goal is achievable if, first, the workers can't live on the money they make. Another obvious goal is actually finding the work satisfying, although this goal is much harder to achieve than to, in a word, make a living, and it's not essential. As far as the customers are concerned, there again is one simple goal: obtaining the product, service of the company at a price deemed reasonable. The customer will evaluate the product or service, decide if it's worth the money, and buy it or not accordingly. Whether or not the customer actually needs the product, unlike the owners who need to make a profit and the workers who need to make a living wage, is an open question. It depends on the business. Unlike the simple needs of owners and workers, the needs of customers are much more complex and harder to categorize. Does the owner of a working iPod need a newer iPod? Does a soccer mom in Florida need an SUV capable of crossing the Sahara? The whole business of marketing or selling comes into play here, and is especially interesting when the buyer has no particular need of what the seller is selling. Okay, now we get into part three. This is going to be the stuff that's actually relevant to debate rounds. This is the stuff you can use. Part three, the operating forces. Regardless of the size of a company or the nature of a company's business, there are constant forces that are always in play. It is the balance of these forces that make this subject interesting, and you need to understand those forces and what happens as the balances of those forces are adjusted and readjusted. If you're examining a business resolution, one way or another, it will probably be the imbalance of these forces that is in question.
Your job will be to analyze how best to balance them. One way or another, these forces affect the owners, the workers, and or the customers. Let's start with the owners. As we said, the owners need first and foremost to make money. If they don't make money, sooner or later, they are out of business. And the first force to think about that is operating on the owner is the cost of goods. What is the cost of goods? Well, at some point, the owner is a customer too, a customer for the raw materials required to manufacture his product, assuming that the owner is in fact manufacturing something, but let's stick with that manufacturing model for the moment. Take cars, for instance. Cars need steel. Steel is the chief component of most cars. So if the price of steel goes up, it will cost more to make cars. So if you are a car manufacturer and the price of steel goes up, what can you do? 1. You can use less steel. This can mean a variety of things. It can mean that you will somehow innovate and find a cheaper product that replaces steel. Or it could mean that you will cut corners and make a car of less quality with less steel. In either case, this would keep the price of manufacturing the car constant, which means you wouldn't have to spend more money on the more expensive steel. Secondly, you can negotiate a better price for the steel that you need. This may or may not succeed, but there may be ways of continuing to buy steel at the old price, such as buying a larger quantity or committing to a longer-term deal. Just as an aside, it's not a manufacturer, but Walmart thrives by making advantageous deals with suppliers to get its goods at the lowest cost. Anyhow, the third thing you can do, if that price of steel goes up, is that you can lower the cost of manufacturing by lowering the cost of labor. That is, not only does it take steel to make cars, but it takes people working in the factory. You can pay the people less to offset the cost of the more expensive steel. That's one possibility. Or you can pay the people the same amount, but fire some of the people so that there's fewer of them you have to pay. Layoffs, in other words, where you shrink the size of your workforce, but in this case, not the amount of your work. That is, you reduce the cost of labor. Fourth thing you can do is you can raise the price of the car, passing the higher cost of the steel along to the customer. Fifth thing you can do is you could choose to make less profit. That is, you could take the higher cost of goods, add it to an unchanged cost of labor, and an unchanged price for the final cars on the lot. This means you will make less money every time you sell a car. The sixth thing you can do is actually not the sixth thing, but it's a combination of the above. Lower the quality a little bit, lay off some of your workers, and still charge a slightly higher price. So what are the ramifications of these possibilities? Let's go back to using less steel. That is, if your cost of goods goes up, you try to find ways of doing things differently. Now, this can be good. It can lead to innovation. This can also be bad. It can lead to poor quality goods. The results can be somewhere in between innovation and poor quality. What about lowering the cost of labor? If you lower the wages of entrenched workers, you can affect their morale, and their workmanship can deteriorate. If you lay off workers, the remaining workers may be overtaxed and too much work to do, and the workmanship can deteriorate. Even if you don't have declining workmanship, you can still incur a decline in morale that makes your workplace unattractive to workers, causing the remaining workers to seek other employment. Companies often compete for the best workers on the assumption that the best workers can do the best job. If your company is known for not treating workers well, you're less likely to get the best workers. What about just taking a hit and not making as much money? Well, most companies are owned by stockholders who expect you, as the managers, to make a profit for them. This is actually a legal obligation of management. If you're managing a company and don't make the stockholders enough profit, they will sooner or later fire you. And if it's just a small company with one owner who has a mortgage and car payments and a couple of kids in college, that one owner still expects a certain amount of profit from him or herself. Unhappiness will result otherwise. And finally, what about passing the higher costs along to the customers? Well, customers won't be happy, and maybe they won't buy your product. If it's something discretionary, maybe they'll just put it off. If it's something they have to have, well, maybe they'll buy less of it. In our car analogy that we've been using, presumably the cost of steel would affect all car manufacturers, all of whom would sooner or later have to raise prices. The customers, having no choice, since no car manufacturer is lowering prices in this period of higher steel costs, will, if at all possible, postpone buying a car because the price is too high. So all car manufacturers sell fewer cars and make less profit unless they raise prices or lay off workers or sell more cars. It's all connected. Cost of goods, cost of labor, cost of products. What will the market bear? What is the best choice the owners can make? Okay, next we look at the labor's operating forces. We talked about the owners and the forces that act on them. One of those forces was labor. Another one was the cost of goods. But goods are usually inanimate, and labor comprises real people doing real work. And real people are more than just a variable in some equation to be manipulated in whatever way makes the equation give what looks like the right answer. Real people have real issues, and those issues are always in play. Workers, we said, have a primary goal of earning a reasonable remuneration for the work being done. This is not just as simple as saying the workers expect to earn a living wage, that is, the amount of money it takes to live. Some jobs just don't pay that much, and you need more than one of them. Or you're a consultant, a freelance operative working for a lot of companies, and it's more than just a paycheck. Many companies offer benefits in addition to salary. In fact, often workers refuse to work without those benefits, which of course raise the cost of labor as far as the owners are concerned. For that matter, workers can be participants in the ownership of the company, getting benefits such as stock in the company as part of their salaries. But regardless of exactly how the workers get their remuneration, they're not doing the work for free, although we can never totally discount job satisfaction as part of the remuneration equation. People hope to like what they do at their jobs. Not all people do, but this is a nice perquisite if you can get it. Sometimes workers will accept less money if there's more satisfaction, or vice versa, will work for less satisfaction if they get paid more money. Each individual has a unique approach to deciding his or her own happiness with the job itself and with its remuneration. The dynamic between owners and workers, and not the specifics of the job itself, is what interests us here. That dynamic is a balance of power. Who has that power and how that power is yielded is a force acting on business that we need to understand. In the simplest understanding, the owners seem to have most of the power. Let's face it, the owners make the rules, the owners set the wages, owners define what the work is and how and where and when it is done. The workers explicitly agree to those rules, whatever they are. That is the contract between owner and labor. In this contract, the worker's only power, if you can call it that, is to not agree to the job in the first place, or to quit if the rules are found disagreeable. Now, when Karl Marx, good old Uncle Karl, looked at this contract back in the 19th century, he didn't think much of it. With all the power in the hands of the owners, realistically, there wasn't much the workers could do. Workers needed to work in order to make money to live. And given the reality of the marketplace, one owner was about the same as another, and so was the work. Marx saw the owners exploiting the workers for their own gain. At the time, labor was not organized, but was simply individuals with no power, forced to earn what the owners said they should earn, doing work that the owners said they should do. The owners controlled the means of production, and there was nothing the workers could do. Marx's solution to this problem was that the workers should control the means of production rather than the parasitical owners who were living off the honest labor of the workers. In other words, he would eliminate the distinction between owners and workers. They would be one and the same thing. The workers would reap all the benefits of their own labor. Workers of the world, unite, he says in the Communist Manifesto. You have nothing to lose but your chains. Marx wrote at great length, of course, about the capitalist system and his solution for its problems, namely communism. The idea was something of a hit. Eventually, revolutions took place in the name of communism, and the communist state was born. At some point, however, worker control of the means of production got confused with state control of the means of production. What, after all, is the state but another name for the citizens of a country in the aggregate? Russian totalitarianism was the end result, where the state took precedence over the citizens. This was not a pretty picture, and eventually we saw the economic failure of the communist model in the century it existed as an alternative to the capitalist model. Communism didn't look quite as interesting in 2005 as it did in 1905. In other words, whether this was endemic to communism or simply the way the ball bounced in the USSR is subject for a different discussion. In any case, one thing Marx got right was recognizing that the cards were stacked against the worker in the uncontrolled capitalist model, and that the workers needed to unite in order to acquire and wield any power. And unite they did in unions, which were very controversial when first seen, and for no other reason than that they were linked to Marxism, which has always been anathema to capitalists, who were the power structure of the day as unions began to organize. It was hard for someone like Andrew Carnegie, a poor young scrapper who built his company from scratch, to see why he wasn't entitled to benefit from the fruit of his labors. Workers had no right to strike, to make demands, to organize. It was his company. Or at least that's what many capitalists thought. But in union there was strength and power. And much of the history of modern business is the taming of the big corporations, not only taming them to grant workers rights, as we're talking about here, but training them to behave in general. No monopolies, safe products, corporate responsibility, all of that. But it's workers' rights we're talking about here. And the only tool workers had to get a share of corporate power was the use of unions and organization. As a result of acquiring that collective power, workers have gained regulated wages, that is, a minimum wage that employers must pay. They've gained equal rights in their employment, safety rules, and a number of other protections. But still, not all corporations are unionized, and not all workers want to be in unions. Aside from some government protections, in many ways, workers are still far less powerful than the owners. Look at Walmart, for example. They resist unionization, and they pay the lowest amount they can to their employees. They are, no question about it, at the borderline of employee abuse, and sometimes they seem to cross that line with great impunity. Their abuses are well known, but the outcry against the corporation seems to be small. Now, why is that? Because in the total picture of owner, worker, and customer, Walmart has an awful lot of customers who are able to buy the company's goods at very low prices. The customers are happy. All those happy customers make the owners happy. And there's a lot of happy owners, as in stockholders. If they had to raise the cost of the workers, somebody would not be happy anymore, which would indicate that the capitalist model isn't exactly perfectly refined yet. So let's look at consumers. So far we've talked about owners and labor, people who provide the products and services. Now let's look at the consumers of those products and services. Now, keeping to the capitalist model, there is an assumption that the intrinsic market forces are all that is necessary for a successful system. That is, aside from the minimalist protections of workers and consumers, which historically have been seen by some capitalists as intrusion on their rights as owners, we let business take care of itself. And by the intrinsic nature of buying and selling in marketplaces, the result will be beneficial to everyone. Adam Smith talked about this. This hands-off approach, or laissez-faire, assumes that supply and demand, need and desire, competition and cooperation will all somehow act as intelligent forces balancing one another, perhaps in some dialectic framework moving toward ever more robust economies over the long term. The most important force in the free market is probably competition. This is, of course, not the interplay of buyers and sellers, but the interplay of multiple sellers to the same buyers. As a consumer, if there is a lot of competition among producers of something I want to buy, that means I will have a lot of choices. Competition means the sellers will have to find ways of getting me to buy their product or services rather than the other guy's product or service. How are they going to do this? Price is one way. If two products are pretty much identical and one costs less than the other, I'll buy the cheaper one. For example, most people buy jeans for $20 or $30 because to most people, jeans are jeans and you might as well buy the cheapest pair. Another way to get me to buy your product is that your product is better. This may be objective, soft toilet paper versus scratchy toilet paper. Or this may be subjective, designer jeans versus those $20 or $30 jeans. There's a whole world of analysis regarding that subjective level. Are designer jeans, or designer anything, worth more than the common garden variety version of the same object? Sellers will do whatever it takes to convince you that their product is different, and if it's more expensive, that it's worth the price. You, as the consumer, make the final decision with your pocketbook. Competition often leads to innovation, which may or may not be rewarded in the marketplace. Apple Computer, for instance, invented the PDA, and they called it the Newton. It flopped. Apple Computer designed an MP3 player, the iPod, plus a very simple music delivery system, iTunes, and they dominated. Why does one product strike the right notes and another miss completely, only to come back later in another guise? Depends on the product. No one will tell you that Betamax wasn't a better system than VHS, but VHS won in the marketplace because, well, its tape lengths were longer. Nuclear power is probably cheaper and safer than any other source of power. Sue me for saying that, but most of us prefer windmills. Go figure. Competition will usually reward value and quality. People will often pay more for something if they think it's worth it. Higher-priced jeans may be dubious, but a Mercedes is worth more money objectively than a Honda Civic. I mean, they're both good cars, and they both do the same job, but they do it differently. And few people wouldn't agree that one is worth more than the other, even if they themselves are unwilling or unable to pay the difference. Some people won't shop at Walmart because they just don't like the supermarket atmosphere. They're willing to pay more to shop in luxury at the Westchester. Same goods, more or less, but a much different atmosphere. If people are willing to pay for something, then there's probably somebody willing to provide it. You pay more for a first-class seat on an airplane than for coach. Same plane, same trip, bigger seat. Worth it? Each customer makes that decision every time a ticket is purchased. Competition can also simply reward clever selling. You can have some piece of crap no better than anybody else's piece of crap, but your advertising campaign is so good, everyone simply has to have your product. This may verge on mind control or mob mentality, but a simple example of this is Nike versus Adidas. Virtually identical products, distinguishable only by their advertising campaigns. Expensive, pervasive ad campaigns that have made Nike way more successful than Adidas, or for that matter, any other sneaker manufacturer. Same crap, different advertising. Go figure. The ultimate theory here is simple. The best will win in the free market. The best product, the best seller, the best value, the best price, the best quality. There's all sorts of definitions of best, but the free market, with its forces working on the consumer and the owner, will lead to the best winning out. This is the dialectic of the marketplace, which is why, coincidentally, we tend to believe in the marketplace of ideas, where there is a dialectic of idea opposed to idea, with the best idea winning out in the long run. The marketplace of ideas is a metaphor based on the model of the marketplace in general. That's where the concept came from in the first place. When you study consumerism, there are some special cases, or at least cases that are quite different from the norm. One of these is the drug industry. As a general rule, a drug manufacturer creates a drug, an expensive, time-consuming process, and patents that drug. To earn back this high cost, we allow exclusivity, a period of patent protection when the manufacturer can earn back his research and development costs. The cost of the drug itself may not be particularly high, but the cost of inventing it was in the bazillions, all out of the pocket of the manufacturer. And U.S. patent law now allows the manufacturer to earn back these costs. As for consumers, the ordinary laws of supply and demand don't apply, where if customers don't like your price, they'll buy from someone else. Consumers, in this case, people with your disease, have no choice and they must pay your price. When the patent elapses, Other manufacturers can start selling your drug, and since they don't have to repay research and development costs, they can sell it based on pure production costs, so the price will drop dramatically. The bottom line here is, if you're going to get a disease, get it after the patent runs out. There are ways around this problem. The government could subsidize the research, but that's often contrary to the normal practices of the free market. And the problem is exacerbated if you don't have a popular disease. There isn't much percentage in a drug company working on a cure for a disease that not many people suffer from. You want to go where the money is. So if you're going to get sick, come down with a popular disease. Again, come down with it after the patent elapses. The best example of the problem in this area is Africa, which leads the world in both AIDS cases and poverty. The AIDS drugs that can control the problem are still radically expensive. Who will pay the cost? Will anyone pay the cost? The drug companies feel an entitlement to earn back their research and development, but people are dying. Who should do what? That's the big question. One thing we mentioned a minute ago was supply and demand. Just to set the record straight, this is how it works. If something people want is in short supply, you can probably charge a lot of money for it. If something people want is in great supply, you probably can't charge a lot of money for it. Theoretically, you see this in the oil business. When the political situation around the world is stable, oil flows around the globe and prices go down. Start just the tiniest little war somewhere, and the price goes up because supply is slowed. Simple as that, and a lot more complicated, but enough of that for now. Next, let's look at the government. By now you may be wondering, where does the government fit in all of this? Well, one area is worker protection. The government can set a minimum wage to ensure fair pay, and the government can ensure that workers have the ability to unionize if they choose to do so. The government can set standards of safety and laws to prevent discrimination. There's a wide range of degrees in which the government can involve itself in providing worker protection, although in capitalist society, the tendency is to provide less rather than more protection. The more intervention in business by the government, the more socialistic the government becomes. That is, the means of production are owned by all the people, and all the people means the state, whereas in capitalist systems, businesses more or less are left alone, laissez-faire. Probably an ideal system is where the government provides some basic protections, no more and no less, and other than that, workers are on their own. Another area government has a role is in the assurance of fair trade, a fair marketplace. Let's go back to that car analogy we were using before. One of the problems with the company raising its prices is that its competitors can all of a sudden get a selling advantage. If the price of Fords goes up, while the price of Chevrolets remains constant or goes down, well, that's an advantage for Chevy. But if they get together, Ford and Chevy can ensure that neither of them takes a hit. They can agree to sell at the same price for their mutual protection. But Ford and Chevy cannot get together behind closed doors and agree to set a price to protect themselves. That is price fixing, and it's illegal. It's businesses ganging up on the consumers. Similarly, if there was only one seller of cars, that is a monopoly, the government could act to prevent that one seller from acting in a monopolistic fashion, for instance, price gouging. Sometimes the government breaks up big companies that have become monopolies, like Microsoft. Microsoft was forced to readjust its software because of its monopolistic practices, for instance. They had to remove Internet Explorer from the basic Windows build, among other things. Netscape had brought that suit against them originally, claiming that the Windows build prohibited competition. Microsoft lost the case. But Netscape virtually went out of business anyhow, so the answer to who really won is something else altogether. Additionally, the government protects the consumers from unscrupulous or shoddy businesses. The government issues standards for products and imposes penalties when those standards are not met. There are standards of safety for cars, for instance, and drugs and food. These are set by and administered by the government with varying levels of intensity, usually depending on the nature of what they're evaluating. So the government protects workers, protects consumers, and in the capitalist system protects the free market itself by disallowing monopolistic practices. In a socialist system, the government would protect the fixed market and similarly protect workers. But we're mostly interested in capitalist questions, and in capitalist systems, one thing is important to remember. The government may protect markets and workers and even corporations, but the government is not in business itself. Some businesses are so vital, transportation and power utilities, for example, that the government hand is much stronger than, say, Ben and Jerry's in the ice cream business, but those businesses are still ultimately independent, owned by stockholders, in the general public. Aside from the post office and, of course, the military, I can't think of any business owned and operated solely by the U.S. government. You can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure that I'm not. So let's summarize. A simple construct of business is multifaceted, but can be boiled down depending on what you're looking at or what you're looking for. There's the buyers and the sellers, if that's your dichotomy. There's the owners and the workers, if that's your dichotomy. And there's producers and consumers. How you frame the construct will depend on what you're trying to investigate, that is, the nature of the resolution. Regardless of the construct, the best situation is a balance of the elements. One pretty good example of good balance is Apple, or at least Apple in early 2006. It's a good place to work, it sells high-quality products, its prices are reasonable, its stockholders are making money, and the corporation constantly innovates. Owners, workers, and consumers are all happy. That's a very good capitalist paradigm. On the imbalance side, there's good old Walmart. The company certainly makes money for the owners, and the customers get a great deal, but the workers are unhappy because they don't feel that they're being treated well. The workers have some recourse to government intervention, but it may take more to solve for them. It may take customers giving up low prices or owners giving up high profits. Something has got to give somewhere, or else we will have to just accept that the largest corporation in the history of civilization, I love saying that, Walmart is the largest corporation in the history of civilization, it can maintain its success only at the expense of underpaid workers. Is that how we're willing to define successful capitalism? Limited goods, like oil or diamonds, are another special case. Some, like oil, are a necessity, and some, like diamonds, are a luxury. But both of these, at least, are limited resources, and both are controlled by cartels. A cartel is like a monopoly, an organization of some sort designed to limit competition. OPEC is the oil cartel. De Beers is the diamond cartel. These people set the price for their resource, and the rest of us are stuck paying that price whether we want to or not in the case of oil, or in the case of diamonds, paying the price if we really want diamonds and can afford them in the first place. A cartel can exist only when there's no competition. At the point when someone invents imitation oil, or when people don't care about diamonds anymore, OPEC and De Beers and the interests they represent will go out of business. Another issue worth pointing out in the dynamic between owner and worker in the more industrialized nations is that owners, if they are so inclined, can find cheaper workforces in less developed nations. It used to be simple manufacturers that were outsourced to the third world, things like clothing and cheap household goods. Now it's also services like telephone support systems in India. It's an easy bargain for the owners and these foreign workers. The owners pay less than they would for Americans doing the same job, and the foreign workers make more than they would otherwise. It's a good deal. Except that it leaves American workers flailing around, unemployed. And if you're thinking that somehow this ghettoizes the third world laborers, once upon a time, made in Japan meant that you were holding a piece of crap in your hands. Now, after Sony and Honda and the like, made in Japan meant top drawer. So there's no capitalistic law that ensures that the third world will remain the third world or that any country is doomed to be a permanent backwater. It all depends on the country and what they make of the influx of money. Finally, you could discount capitalism altogether in a business resolution and run something else. The problem with this, especially with a capitalism is bad case, is that you're up against history, where in the dialectic of economic systems, capitalism has definitely won out. In head-to-head competition, mano a mano, capitalism has beaten the crap out of communism. Running cap bad with any older judge who understands history is a risky business and unlikely to succeed. There are other economic approaches, most notably the third way. But do you really want to espouse something few people know much about? With business topics, I recommend sticking to the relatively straight and narrow. It seems to me that we've talked about all sorts of real and meaningful aspects of business here. These should be your starting places for attacking a resolution. Find the imbalance and go about fixing it for your side. Your cases should follow naturally.